members of the resistance. The likes of General Hejazi and General Soleimani trained many resistance members who have turned into flag bearers of the resistance axis.
Hejazi's name goes hand in hand with Major General Qasem Soleimani, an anti-terror military commander who was assassinated in a U.S. air raid in Iraq in January 2020. IRGC officials say Hejazi stood shoulder to shoulder with General Soleimani in the fight against Daesh terrorists in Iraq and Syria.
When it comes to the fight against Daesh terrorists, General Hejazi played a key role in training the resistance fighters both physically and ideologically to readily fight the terror group. He led several operations that dealt heavy blows to the terrorists.
General Hejazi joined the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps during the early days of its establishment in 1979. He was a veteran of the eight-year Iraqi-imposed war on Iran in the 1980s, before being appointed as the head of the Basij, a paramilitary force affiliated to the IRGC. Hejazi also served as an intelligence and security advisor to Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. He became the deputy commander of the Quds Force in late January 2020 after the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani. He was on the list of the U.S. and Europe sanctions as part of bans imposed on the IRGC.
From serving in the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s to fighting terrorism in the region, General Hejazi grew to become a vital piece in the IRGC's activities, so that the military force still mourns his death as a huge loss. That's, quote, irreplaceable. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A hearing to review the case of a Palestinian prisoner has been held at an Israeli court. After the hearing, the court said Ahmad Manasra's case doesn't apply under terrorism laws. This means his lawyers can appeal for his release. Mona Kandil reports from Ramallah.
Ahmad Manasra, this Palestinian youth who was arrested 6 years ago when he was only 13 years old, is suffering mental health issues due to torture and solitary confinement he faces in Israeli jail. Ahmad's lawyers had appealed to the Israeli court against a special prison committee's rejection of a request to have Ahmad's case reviewed by a parole committee after he had served two-thirds of his sentence. The Israeli court of Bir al-Sabah held a hearing to review Ahmad's case. They only decided that his case doesn't come under the terrorism law.
Ahmad Manasra is an example of the persecution of children in Palestine. He's a child who was arrested while he was 13 years old only. He was persecuted, he was oppressed, he was tortured, and he was frightened, and he has become a victim of physical and psychological abuse from the Israeli side. That's why there is a huge campaign now demanding his release.
After years of his detention, no one can forget the video of an Israeli interrogator violently questioning a Palestinian child. In the video, Israeli interrogator kept screaming at Ahmad and accusing him of lying. Ahmad repeatedly told the interrogator that he couldn't remember. Ahmad was referring to the day when Israeli settlers opened fire at him and left him bleeding on the ground after being run over by an Israeli settler's car. Israeli settlers cursed him, damning him to death. This came after his 15-year-old cousin Hassan was shot dead by Israeli settlers. They accused both Ahmad and Hassan of attempting to carry out a knife-stabbing attack.
The Israeli committee originally rejected looking into Ahmad Mansara's file on the basis that its case falls under the terrorism law. Now, after the latest ruling, Ahmad's lawyers want to request to have his case reviewed by a parole committee. He has served 6 of his 9-year sentence and is suffering from mental health issues.
A global solidarity campaign has pressured the Israeli courts to hold a hearing to review and possibly appeal Ahmad's case.
The Israeli court has only decided to cancel the previous decision that Ahmad Manasra's case comes under the so-called terrorism law. However, Ahmad's family and lawyers hope that the next session will be soon, as there is a serious need to release Ahmad immediately due to his severely deteriorated mental condition. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak are fighting for their political lives. This after it emerged both men were amongst dozens to receive fines from the Met for their part in Partygate, the series of gatherings that took place during the height of COVID restrictions in and around the corridors of British power. Labour leader Keir Starmer led the chorus of voices urging them to go.
But the guilty men are the Prime Minister and the Chancellor. They've dishonoured all of that sacrifice. They've dishonoured their office. This is the first time in the history of our country that a Prime Minister has been found to be in breach of the law. And then he lied repeatedly to the public about it. Britain deserves better. They have to go.
The Chancellor has issued a statement giving his unreserved apologies over the matter. The Prime Minister, however, attempted an explanation of sorts.
There was a brief gathering in the Cabinet Room shortly after 2 p.m, lasting for less than 10 minutes, during which people I work with kindly passed on their good wishes. And I have to say, in all frankness, at that time, it did not occur to me that this might have been a breach of the rules. But of course, the police have found otherwise, and I fully respect the outcome of their investigation.
Johnson's critics feel the Prime Minister not only failed the British people with his leadership during the peak of COVID, but continued to do so with these fresh revelations.
I'm stunned. In all British history, no Prime Minister has ever been fined by the police before. And this is a law he introduced, that we all spent 2 years basically in self-isolation. And he's just having not just one party, but about a dozen of these parties. And for somebody who makes the law, who is our Prime Minister, to then break it so many times, he shouldn't just be resigning from office. He should be going to prison.
The support being shown to the Prime Minister and the Chancellor will be of cold comfort to those who lost loved ones during COVID. And the apologies of both men will ring hollow to those who managed to make the ultimate sacrifice and who are now wondering why those who made the rules seemed incapable of following them. Amina Taylor, London.
It's the second time in 7 months that Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein has visited Tehran. The Iraqi diplomat's trip came upon an invitation by his Iranian counterpart, Hossein Amir Abdullahian. The two-hour talks were held behind closed doors, but from what the joint presser suggests, regional security topped the discussions.
We appreciate the role played by the Republic of Iraq in maintaining regional understanding. We also talked about Syria and expressed our opposition to the fact that parts of Syria are still occupied by military bases of other countries without seeking permission from Syria's central government. We also talked about Afghanistan. Iran and Iraq welcome an all-inclusive government in Afghanistan that encompasses all ethnic groups.
Iraq has been mediating talks between Tehran and Riyadh over ways to resume diplomatic ties between the two regional rivals. After more than 5 years of icy relations, Iran and the Arab Kingdom stand on opposition sides in the Saudi war on Yemen, which has been ongoing since 2014, with Iran calling for a ceasefire. The Iraqi foreign minister says a fifth round of talks due in mid-March was suspended, calling on both sides to quickly resume the discussions.
Iraq and Iran's security is tied to the security of the region, so Iraq will continue to play its part as a mediator for dialogues between Iran and Saudi Arabia to hopefully bring the two countries back to diplomatic relations.
The Iranian foreign minister, for his part, thanked Baghdad's constructive role in brokering the Saudi-Iranian talks, saying Tehran is ready to come back to the negotiating table.
We thank efforts made by the Honorable Prime Minister and Foreign Minister of Iraq to resume Saudi-Iranian talks. We welcome this initiative. When it comes to the Saudi war in Yemen, we believe that a sustainable ceasefire, the removal of the humanitarian blockade, and a Yemeni-Yemeni discussion without any foreign intervention could help the Yemeni people decide their fate.
Iraq and Iran are close political and security partners. This partnership was best manifested during the fight against Daesh terrorists in Iraq, when Tehran helped dislodge the terror group there. But when it comes to trade ties, both sides agree that they need to do more, putting the current bilateral trade volume between the two countries at roughly $14 billion. The two sides now agree to take steps to at least double this figure.
Tehran and Baghdad's ties are basically defined by security cooperation. But let's not forget that Iraq was among the countries that maintained their economic cooperation with Tehran in the peak of U.S. sanctions on Iran. Now, this last visit is seen as another step forward in the two sides' trade and security cooperation. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Uncertain times for millions of Brits. A sharp spike in the cost of living combined with stagnant pay rates mean many are counting the pennies and being forced into making stark choices.
I've got a broken back right now with metal screw and bone in my back. And the pain with the arthritis I've got is horrible. And the cost of living, of electric and gas and petrol and food, is horrible. You know what I have to do? Go from shop to shop to buy cut price things which is on sale.
There's going to be people out there that are too afraid to switch on a kettle for some hot water. You know, that kettle is going to cost me 46p to boil. No. No one should be living like this. This isn't the Stone Age. I'm not going down a mine this afternoon. This is 2022.
The signs for British householders have been ominous. Interest rates hitting a record high of 6.2% earlier this year, supply issues associated with Brexit, the global impact of COVID, a spike in energy costs, the crisis in Ukraine, and a hike in national insurance contributions have all contributed. Food bank use amongst working people has hit record highs, with ever more falling into debt, according to published figures. There's a growing sense of frustration and desire to cast blame.
What the government is doing, the government has to look into this matter. They should think that what the common people will do, what they will do, they cannot survive in this country.
I'm appalled that we are left in this situation. We've just came through 2 years of COVID, and now, by the way, people, here you go, energy cap. It feels like the government is like, oh, well, you've just came through hell. Here's a little bit more.
The terrifying reality is that for millions of Brits, this is simply the beginning. Flash forward a few months when temperatures would have plummeted and savings, if any, depleted. We'll start to see a real rise in half-empty fridges and bare cupboards and a growing sense of desperation, despair and anger. Boris Johnson's government says it's doing more than any other administration to lift Brits out of poverty. On recent evidence, there will be millions who wholeheartedly disagree. Amina Taylor, London.
As a neighbouring country, Iran has always been a second house for Afghans. Over 5 million Afghan refugees are living in Iran today. Following a stabbing attack at Imam Reza Shrine in Mashhad that left two clerics dead, the Afghan society condemned the move, extending messages of solidarity and sympathy with the Iranian people.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has been a kind host to millions of Afghan refugees for more than four decades. Iran provides our Afghan legal and illegal refugees with jobs as well as educational, medical and other facilities. I wish Iranians enjoy peace and condemn any attack on their country, as it has served as a second home for Afghan people.
I extend my deep condolences to the Iranian people over the barbaric attack on a number of clerics at Imam Reza Holy Shrine. Not only me, but also the whole Afghan nation were saddened after the attack. The enemies of Islam and the two nations are pushing conspiracies to sow sedition, but we won't let anyone to ruin our solidarity.
Afghans also echo Iran's voice against enemies' plots and Cold War. Experts say neither the knife attacker in Mashhad represents Afghans, nor allegations of Iran mistreating Afghan refugees are true. They believe enemies of the two nations are using the media to sow discord.
The Mashhad incident that left two clerics dead was orchestrated by Takfiri groups and the enemies of Iran and Afghanistan. We should be aware that how they are trying to target our friendship. The stabbing attacker never represents the Afghan people, but it was meant to push Afghanophobia in Iran. On the other hand, the West is sowing Iranophobia in Afghanistan by fake viral pictures, while we know that Iran is generously hosting Afghan refugees.
This comes as the two nations are expanding relations in different political, cultural, and economic areas. The two neighboring countries, Iran and Afghanistan, have long been close partners. People here thank Iran for peacefully housing millions of Afghan refugees. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Families of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and prisoners' rights activists held a sit-in outside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza. They protested Israel's inhumane treatment of thousands of Palestinian political prisoners. Palestinian prisoners see no end in sight to their suffering, as hundreds of them are being held without charge under the so-called administrative detention, where incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely. According to Palestinian human rights groups, the Israeli regime has issued over 50,000 administrative detention orders against Palestinians, including women and minors, since 1967.
My message for the international community is that they must put their efforts against the policies of Israel that result in suffering of our prisoners, and we wish freedom for them and all the prisoners.
According to the Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, Palestinian prisoners are subjected to harsher treatment in Israeli detention centers during the holy month of Ramadan.
During the month of holy Ramadan, the Israeli occupation deprived the Palestinian detainees from organizing the collective prayers like Taraweeh and Fajr prayers. And also the food is not enough. They provide the meals with bad quantity and quality.
Solidarity with Palestinian prisoners has been a top priority for activists in Gaza, who say they are determined to stand by the prisoners for as long as it takes.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, thousands of Palestinians, including around 500 administrative detainees, are behind bars in Israeli jails. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today, and exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Spotlight. Tensions are simmering in the occupied Palestinian territories. Israeli forces attack Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque during the fasting month of Ramadan. More than 150 Palestinians were injured and another 400 arrested in the attack. Following the raid, thousands of Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip also took to the streets in solidarity with the worshippers. Officials from the resistance movements Hamas and the Islamic Jihad condemned the attack, pledging to defend Al-Aqsa at any price. Israeli regime has intensified their crackdown across the occupied West Bank, killing over a dozen Palestinians since April the 10th. Palestinians have ramped up retaliatory attacks against Israeli forces in recent weeks, an indication that Palestinians remain determined to keep fighting against the Israeli occupation and the normalization of ties between the Israeli regime and some Arab governments. Joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have author and researcher Daniel Yegich joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. And also journalist, author, and activist Fra Hughes is joining us from Belfast.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
General, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Yegich in Beirut. How do you view the recent wave of violence against Palestinians carried out by the Israeli regime against worshippers during the holy month of Ramadan and at the much-revered Al-Aqsa Mosque?
I mean, this latest, the latest wave of violence is another form, another manifestation of Israeli state terrorism that the Israeli apartheid regime has been using to oppress Palestinians in many ways, and in particular, of course, on religious holidays. This has been a systematic part and parcel of the Israeli occupation regime for decades now, where they would attack Palestinians in holy places on particular holidays, just out of mere hatred, driven by the hatred for Palestinians, for their religion, and for their mere freedom and humanity. And the latest pictures and videos that we've seen from today just show once again the brutality of the Israeli terror regime that has dehumanized Palestinians to an extent that it just uses all sorts of weapons against defenseless people in order to terrorize them. But I think it also shows the weakness of the Zionist regime, because this is a war that the colonizer cannot win. Palestinians are still there. Palestinians do go to their holy places on holidays to worship. And I think this also shows the fragility of the Israeli project, because it reminds the colonizer that the colonized population, the indigenous population, still adheres to their traditions and religions and lives their culture despite this terror regime that the Israelis have been developing to a very high and sophisticated degree over for more than seven decades now.
Frau Hughes, there were a number of reprisal attacks against Israelis, some even in the heart of Tel Aviv. Give us your perspective on the significance of these recent events as Palestinians are venting their anger at the regime's crimes and occupation.
I think what we're witnessing is a direct response to the violence and the cowardly brutality being visited upon the Palestinian people in Al-Aqsa, in Al-Quds, and in the occupied territories. So I think with every action, there is a reaction, and the reaction from people who have been militarily oppressed, beaten, jailed, had their houses bulldozed, had their land confiscated, had their water stolen, their lives and their dreams, is to prove to the Israeli government and wider Israeli society that they are not safe in Tel Aviv. They are not safe in anywhere in historic 48 Palestine. People believe, I think, in Israeli society that all the violence and the threat of violence from Palestinians is limited to both Gaza and to the West Bank. But forms of resistance that are found on the state of Israel itself proves that there is nowhere to hide. There is no safe place for Israelis who go to the West Bank and brutalize the indigenous population, who bomb Gaza from the air and from the sea and from the land, and think that they are safe in their homes and in their clubs and in their places of work in Tel Aviv and in all of occupied 48 Palestine.
Sure, Mr. Yegich, Hamas's pledge to defend Al-Aqsa at any price. Islamic Jihad described the attack as a crime and said Israel is responsible for the repercussions of its aggression. The PA also reacted too, saying that aggression against Al-Aqsa is equivalent to crossing all red lines. Summing up all of that, observers and analysts say we could be looking at the prelude of a third intifada. How do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, especially if you look into the situation that we had approximately a year ago, it was quite similar with the holy month of Ramadan and the Easter celebrations being overshadowed by Israeli attacks on worshippers in Al-Quds and other places in Palestine, which has triggered a very strong response from the Palestinian resistance. So in many ways, there are parallels between the situation today and the way it was a year ago. And again, I mean, Palestinians have the right to defend themselves with all means at their disposal against this terror regime. And the Israeli regime cannot think that any settler should feel safe at any point, given that their presence on the stolen indigenous land in itself is a violation of Palestinian rights. And I think it is, there are different episodes of so-called escalations of violence, but effectively there's a structural violence that Palestinians do resist against in their daily lives, sometimes just by merely existing, which already for the settler colonial regime, the existence and survival of the indigenous people is a form of threat and violence. Now, when it comes to the question of armed resistance, of course, there might be Palestinian responses. And again, Palestinians have the right to defend themselves. That is enshrined in international law, UN resolutions. But even beyond that, I'm mentioning international law, but still there are no international mechanisms that would protect Palestinians from Israeli violations of this law. But of course, Palestinians have the right to defend themselves. And depending on, of course, how the situation evolves in the next days, we may see more such reactions potentially.
Farah Hughes, let's talk about the normalization deals. As the Israelis expand ties with Arab governments, grassroots Palestinian reactions are increasing. Is this a clear sign from Palestinians showing how they feel about these deals, about Israel trying to legitimize the occupation through these U.S.-crafted normalization deals?
Well, I think what you have is the United States and Israel are trying to create like a coalition of the willing within West Asia, with potentially the idea behind this that there might be some form of a unified army across some of these countries like the United Arab Emirates, like Saudi Arabia, working in conjunction and on behalf of Zionism and Western imperialist interests within the region. I think what's happening on the ground in Palestine is a directly correlated to what's happening in the wider political sphere within the region. But I think from the Israeli terrorism that we're seeing at present, this is a form of total control over the occupied territories and the people within it. So the tighter they turn the screw of repression, the more Palestinian resistance and the Palestinians will filter through the clenched fist of the Israeli military occupation, because those people are resisting the very fact that Israel tries to control residential permits, work permits, the right of movement, the right of access across borders, the right to medicine, the right to healthcare, the right to education. So I think Palestinians will continue to resist. I think the Zionist forces will continue their attack upon Al-Aqsa Mosque, because I believe that there is a determination there to eventually turn the Al-Aqsa Mosque into a second Ibrahim Mosque in Hebron, where you will find that the Israeli Zionist religious settlers more and more violating the holy sanctuary of the mosque, with the intention of someday taking total control of the mosque, which is why we see such valiant resistance from men, women and children in Al-Quds and further afield to defy the Israeli Zionist machine from totally dominating their lives.
All right, Mr. Yegij, Palestinians have condemned the agreements, these normalization agreements, as a betrayal of Jerusalem al-Quds. Iran has strongly condemned the Israeli attacks at Al-Aqsa Mosque, saying that the regime has become more aggressive as a result of some Arab rulers abandoning the Palestinians and their cause. Do you think that these Arab governments have effectively turned a blind eye to the suffering of their Arab brethren, and that has also emboldened the Israeli regime even more?
Yes, I do think so. These Arab regimes that have normalized their ties with the Israeli regime have, of course, even before the normalization, not really cared about the struggle for liberation of Palestine. The Palestinian struggle is rooted in the idea of liberation, of freedom, of resisting the colonization and freeing the land. And this has a lot of support amongst Arab states, amongst populations, and beyond the Arab states. In the Third World, in the Global South, and even in the West, Palestinians do enjoy support by many people. Now, what we see in the Arab regimes in the Persian Gulf is that there are dictatorships, that are absolutist monarchies, that are are not elected by their population, so they don't have the legitimate democratic, not representing democratically their populations. And many of these regimes themselves are, having to find ways to manifest their and consolidate their power. So they're in many ways natural allies to the Israeli regime. Now, when it comes to the issue of Palestine, of course, this has never been a major issue for these regimes. And in fact, having a military and so-called security and surveillance cooperation with the Israeli regime strengthens their own legitimacy somehow, or at least their position geopolitically, as well as their ties to the United States. But I think that the normalization agreements have made this the circumstances are quite obvious, very official to an extent that Palestinians do not have to expect any sort of solidarity from these regimes. And yes, I do think that this has somehow strengthened the Israeli regime, because now it does enjoy backing from several Arab countries in its terrorism against the Palestinian population.
Frau Hughes, let's talk about the international response. We do see a clear double standard when countries that are quick to condemn, for example, Hamas retaliatory missile strikes, that was the case last year around the same time, those very countries are silent during forcible takeovers of homes, brutal suppression of demonstrators, and when places of worship come under assault, like today when Israeli forces desecrate the Al-Aqsa Mosque. How do you view this inconsistency?
Well, I'd say firstly, the attacks on the Al-Aqsa Mosque are, they're not unprecedented, because we've seen it several times before, but they're maybe unprecedented in the world political sphere. It's not often that a government gets to go into a place of worship, brutalize the worshippers, fire tear gas and open fire with live bullets. I think the hypocrisy you're seeing from the West is nothing new. Israel is a European Zionist colonial project within West Asia. It has the backing first of Britain, more recently of America. It has the EU giving it political cover and the fig leaf that allows this brutality to go on day and daily. We in the West are bombarded 24/7 by propaganda, which is in the interest of Zionism. It's in the interest of Western imperialism. It's in the interest of the European Union, because that is what we see. We see European televised news. We see European press news. We see and read and listen to the radio and the newspapers. So the first casualty of war is truth. But I mean, the second casualty is obviously propaganda that we are suffering from day and daily. And just briefly, if you look at what's happening in Ukraine and compare it to the coverage of what's happening inside Jerusalem and inside Palestine, we see the leader of Ukraine, President Zelensky, to make Ukraine a new Israel within Europe. So I think what we are going to have and what it proves is that the fascism in Ukraine is mirrored by the fascism within Israel itself. And this is why there is a dichotomy and a divergence of the coverage of different conflicts. And the Palestinians are abandoned because the West wants Israel to succeed, and it wants the Arab nations and the Arab region to stay under American hegemony and European political control.
Daniel Yegich, Mr. Hughes brought up the issue of Ukraine. Can we try and draw some comparison between the international response to the Ukraine conflict and the seven-decade-old occupation of Palestine? Why hasn't Israel been sanctioned and pressured and shunned by the international community to end its occupation against Palestine?
Yeah, I think if we compare the reactions by the so-called international community to what is happening in Ukraine right now and what's been happening in Palestine for about a century now, we can draw the conclusion that this is a manifestation of hypocrisy and white supremacy. When it comes to the media coverage, as well as political statements around Ukraine, this has been a central focus for the so-called international community. Also here, oftentimes when we refer to the international community, it is oftentimes Western Europe, North America, and other settler colonies, while the majority of the world's population is excluded oftentimes from the dominant implications implications of this term. And so within this hegemonic discourse, Ukraine has been at the center. We've seen Western political leaders as well as mainstream media commending the Ukrainian civilians who are taking up arms to fight against Russia. We've seen a clear support for Ukraine's right to defend itself, for armed so-called resistance, whereas, of course, in the case of Palestine, this is oftentimes in advance and generally generalized and condemned as forms of terrorism. Now, of course, again, there are many similarities between Ukraine and Israel. An Israeli project, but effectively, I mean, Israel is a European settler colony, a European outpost in Western Asia, and it enjoys the backing of the European Union. It's part of European identity. This is why, again, yet today, with the latest, very well, audiovisually, very well documented instances of state terrorism by the Zionist regime against defenseless Palestinians, European Union bureaucrats came out again with these same old statements that they bring up, claiming that they are concerned. They're urging all sides to de-escalate, that there is no room for extremism, and so on, using euphemisms and downplaying the violence of the Israeli regime that the Israeli regime perpetuates so clearly and visibly. So to that extent, the European Union is actually doing propaganda and public diplomacy work on behalf of the Israeli regime, and is as such deeply complicit, of course, also in many different ways in terms of arming the settler colony and providing it with support. But I think this is just one of the many ways in which we see this hypocrisy and, again, the centrality of this white supremacist Eurocentric ideals when it comes to the representation of Palestine and Ukraine.
Frahu's final thoughts from you. The Israeli racism and brutality has been evident enough that Human Rights Watch has in numerous reports labeled Israel's policies towards the Palestinians as apartheid. But apartheid needs international action. Need I not remind anyone of South Africa? So when will we see this international action? And what more does the world need to see and hear?
Sadly, I'm not sure we will ever see that international action. As someone who lives in the West, as someone who lives in Ireland, what I see in general is that the people of the West, and indeed the southern global south, the people are with the Palestinians, but the government, the elite, the corporations, and the people who have power and influence are very much with the Zionists. So it's going to take the BDS movement, it's going to take people like me, people like our friends in Beirut, people like our friends all over the European continent, South America and Africa, to come together and demand justice and dignity for the people of Palestine, and to demand an end to the Israeli Zionist barbaric apartheid repressive brutality which is visited day and daily upon the Palestinian people. So unless there is a huge groundswell from members of the public, from working class people all over the world, sadly I do not see there being any pressure put on the Zionist regime. It is more likely that it will be the Palestinians within historic Palestine, Gaza, and the occupied West Bank who will eventually put enough pressure upon the military regime within the Zionist government in order to force some form of a democratic settlement with equality for all the people within the region. But sadly, I don't see it happening anytime soon.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Author and researcher Daniel Yegic joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Journalist, author, and activist Frog Hughes joining us from Belfast. And also special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's edition of Spotlight. It's good night for now.
IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
A recent study by researchers at the University of California, San Francisco found that more than 2 million fentanyl-filled fake pills were seized by U.S. law enforcement agencies in the last quarter of 2021 alone, an indication of how common they have become in the nation's illicit drug supply. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Erin McCormick titled U.S. Teen Overdose Deaths Double in 3 Years Amid Fentanyl Crisis. Stay tuned for more. A new study has found drug overdose deaths among high school-aged U.S. teens have more than doubled since 2019, driven by a rise in the deadly opioid fentanyl. Researchers at the University of California, Los Angeles, who analyzed mortality rates among 14 to 18-year-olds over the past decade, found that while drug use among this age group is actually falling, fatalities are on the rise, jumping from 492 in 2019 to 954 in 2020, then climbing to 1,146 in 2021. Researchers attribute this to a flood of counterfeit pills, which look exactly like real oxycodone or Xanax tablets, but actually contain fentanyl, a synthetic opioid so potent that one counterfeit pill can prove fatal. Vast quantities of these fake pills are being smuggled into the country and are circulating in the illicit drug market, meaning that teens often ingest the deadly drug unknowingly. Joseph Friedman, who led the study published on April 12th in JAMA, said, "We are seeing really young kids start to die because the illicit drug supply has become extremely toxic." The study found that the rates of drug deaths are highest among indigenous and Hispanic teens, but that young people of all races are affected. Friedman said it's scary stuff, adding the deaths represented the major first overdose spike seen in adolescence since tracking began. Teens are continuing to experiment with pills. The pills are just getting much more deadly. A recent study by researchers at the University of California, San Francisco, found that more than 2 million fentanyl-filled fake pills were seized by law enforcement agencies in the last quarter of 2021 alone, an indication of how common they have become in the nation's illicit drug supply. The UCLA study cited survey data showing that the number of 10th graders reporting having used drugs in the past year held the steady at about 30% between 2010 and 2020 and then dropped to only 18% during 2021 as the pandemic stretched on. Morgan Godwin, a Portland, Oregon-based drug addiction researcher and co-author of the study, said, "A really important fact here is that more kids are not doing drugs," adding, "The drugs they are doing are just
incredibly more lethal. The study comes at a time when the number of overdose deaths in the U.S. has exploded to more than 100,000 a year due to the huge amounts of fentanyl and other synthetic opioids saturating the country's drug supply. Fentanyl is as much as 100 times more potent than morphine. Friedman said these counterfeit pills are spreading across the nation and teens may not realize they are dangerous. The researchers said while many adult users may know the pills they are buying on the street markets actually contain fentanyl, youth most likely believe they are getting genuine pharmaceuticals. Godwin said kids think that pills are very safe, adding because while they might not have been prescribed to them, they were supposedly prescribed to someone, and young people believe the purity does not vary. In reality, though, the opioid dosages in counterfeit pills can vary dramatically. The Drug Enforcement Administration estimates that 4 in 10 seized pills contain potentially lethal doses. The authors call for more drug education in the schools, giving kids realistic information about how to protect themselves from fentanyl. Friedman said high school might be too late, adding we need to include information about drugs on the street in school even earlier. The researchers said youth should also be given education about and access to Narcan, the overdose reversal drug which can revive someone who has overdosed, and fentanyl test strips which can detect counterfeit pills. Researchers and youth advocacy groups say teens are often easily able to obtain the pills from friends or from local dealers who offer them on social media apps like Snapchat or Instagram and sometimes deliver them straight to teenagers' homes. Guardian interviews with families that lost teenagers to accidental overdoses from fentanyl pills show that it can happen to anyone. In February 2021, Sammy Berman Chapman, a 16-year-old straight student and the son of the television trappist Laura Berman, died in his bedroom in Los Angeles after taking what he thought was single Xanax. In Arizona in 2020, Zach Plunk, a 17-year-old star high school running back, died after taking one tablet, labeled to look just like a pharmaceutical M30 oxycodone pill. In both cases, the tablets bought over social media turned out to be deadly doses of fentanyl. Snapchat recently announced increased measures to combat drug dealing on the platform, while Instagram has said the company works to remove such content. Plunk's mother, Wendy Plunk, said it's just so sickening, adding there is still not enough being done to stop kids from getting the fake pills over social media sites and to warn them about the danger. She said we need to get the word out. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, more than 100,000 people died from overdoses in the U.S. in a 12-month period ending in April 2021. Drug researchers say it's the biggest increase ever seen in the U.S. and it's only rising each month. Nora Volko, director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, told The Guardian fentanyl is driving the majority of those deaths, associated with at least 60% of the fatal overdoses, a 50% increase in a single year. She said it's devastating, adding it's an epidemic within the pandemic. Deaths from fentanyl were already on the rise across the country, but the pandemic supercharged their speed and intensity. Volko said it's not unusual to see people turn to drugs or alcohol during times of crisis, adding, but what we didn't expect was that during that period, there will be a massive increase in the entry of these illicit substances into the country. Dramatically more fentanyl is coming into the U.S., making the drug supply increasingly dangerous. Daniel Sicaron, the Justice Minor Endowed Professor of Addiction Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, said, the trajectory is up with no leveling off, adding there is nothing that says it's slowing down. He said a triple wave of opioids from pain pills to heroin to fentanyl is wreaking havoc. Another alarming trend is rising with the dominance of fentanyl. People who have never used opioids before are dying from single fatal encounter with fentanyl. Volko said they are not opioid users and they don't know that these drugs are contaminated and they die with one single exposure. Even for those who are accustomed to taking opioids, it can be difficult to judge a safe dosage of fentanyl. Most experienced drug users don't prefer it, but as prescription pills and heroin became harder to get, dealers have increasingly begun mixing fentanyl into the supply. Experts and grieving families are seeing alarming numbers of people, even children, taking what they think are legitimate Percocet or Xanax pills with friends.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.